What's your view of God? I'm speaking to Christians here, not non-Christians. What's your view of God? The answer is it will be inadequate no matter what your view of God is until we see him face to face. I mean, we're going to have a pitifully small view of God, even if you love him dearly and have a high view of him, until we see him face to face. You ever talk to a young child who says, I can drive? And what they mean by that is they've had their hands on the steering wheel and done a little of that. And I think we're all kind of that way. You know, I have a view of God, and it's a great view of God. Well, yeah, but it's pretty small until you see him face to face, I promise you. But your view of God will be even more anemic and even more pathetic if you do not become a student of the Scriptures. You have to be a student of the Scriptures, what God has said and what God has done in people's lives and what their testimony is. You have to be a student of Scripture to have a bigger view of God. Are you a student of the Scriptures? Most people tend to say, well, yes, I study the Scriptures some, not as much as I'd like to, but I study. Where do you read? Well, I study the New Testament. Good. You ever read in the Old Testament? Well, a little bit, but not really. I mainly read the New Testament. Why do you mainly read the New Testament? And their answer is, well, because the Old Testament is kind of confusing to me. It's kind of a black hole. I don't know what to do. It's a little hard for me. And besides that, the New Testament and Jesus is enough. If I just know Jesus, that's enough for me to know God. Well, I'm not about to say anything heretical. I promise you, no one will be shooting me for heresy. But what I'm about to tell you is, no, that's not true. You can love Jesus immensely, but your view of God will still be too small. What? Yeah, it will be. You see, Jesus is God, no doubt about that. And he said, if you want to know who the Father is, come look at me. I mean, no doubt about that. But Jesus does not display the whole sovereign glory, power, wonder, and awesomeness of God. You know why I know that? Because Jesus himself prayed in John 17, Father, would you restore to me the glory that I had before, the glory these disciples haven't seen, the glory the world hadn't seen. Philippians chapter 2, Christ emptied himself. He was God, being in the very form and nature of God, the essence of God, but he emptied himself and took the form of a servant. And we go, you know, I kind of like that servant view best. I don't really want to see the glory, nature, wonder, and awesomeness of God. Book of Revelation points out Jesus actually gets it restored, and when Christ comes back, you'll see all his glory. But wouldn't you like to see some of it now? And the answer to that is sure, absolutely, you need it. Your view of God will be inadequate. Your sense of worship will be limited. Your even description of God will be cheated unless you see his glory and wonder, and the Old Testament is a primary place to see those things. One family, I even like how they did it. One family said that they, as a family, were looking at the word awesome. And the word awesome means take your breath away. I mean, awesome is awe-inspiring, wonderment. And they had realized that the Bible causes you to have this awesome God, this view of God. They banned the word awesome in their family because if God's awesome, you water the word down when you start calling pizza awesome. When pizza is awesome, you have started cheating with a word that's no longer fair to use anymore. It's an awesome God, the Old Testament. Many people will say the Old Testament, isn't the Old Testament just a bunch of bizarre stories? Isn't it kind of a dirty little secret that even among Christians, there's a lot of Christians that go, you know what, I don't think I believe all the stories. I love Jesus, and I'm committed to Jesus, and Jesus is real, and I know that historical and evidence, but that one about the fish and the guy and swallowed, and the guy came out alive, and wink, wink, wink. You know, it's a nice story, three little pigs, Hansel and Gretel, Jonah and the whale. Or what about instantly speaking, a creation occurring? Or what about this worldwide flood? Isn't the Old Testament more legend and myth? Well, Jesus said it was true. You got to start there. Jesus said it was true. Read any page that Jesus has, I mean, what he speaks. Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, I don't care. Take any page. Read a full page. On any page that Jesus speaks, you're going to find that he quotes, refers to, talks about, points out, and uses the Old Testament. Philip Yancey correctly worded it this way. You want to read the Bible Jesus read? You got to read the Old Testament. If you want to accept the Old Testament, the starting point is this: Christ in his power, and Christ in his authority, and Christ in his identity, and there's good reason to accept all of those. He speaks of the Old Testament as factually true. You see, it wasn't a myth or a legend to him. Abel and Noah and Abraham and Lot and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David and Solomon and Elijah and Elisha, and yes, even Jonah, they're spoken of as real people at a real place, real time. Jesus speaks of events and things that took place in places, and he talks like they really happened, Sodom and Gomorrah. In fact, Jesus says to the people of his own day, he says, the men of Nineveh you'll see with your own eyes, because they're going to stand up and indict you for what you yourselves are going to see. Jesus speaks of the creation as a fact, and it's true. When Jesus quotes the Old Testament, he says, God said. If you don't know the Old Testament, you don't know nothing about God. And if you're going to accept Jesus Christ, you have to recognize he's either telling about the truth about that or he's not. And if he's not, he's not telling the truth about anything. The next 4 weeks, we're going to be doing a little series here in September that is intended to help you become a better student of the Old Testament. Better student of Scripture and all, but the Old Testament in particular. In this little series, what we're going to do today is an intro. I'm going to try to help you catch a little bit of a heart for the Old Testament. And this morning, I'm going to brush across this question, is it true? It's a pretty important question. It deserves a whole lot more time. But I think even brushing across it this morning, you'll walk out of here going, wow, yeah, there's a wow factor here. Is it true? If it's not true, it's irrelevant, by the way. Next week, what we're going to do is, what's God's big panoramic view? What's the Old Testament about? I mean, is it just a collection of bizarre stories, or is there really a plan? And so we'll go through, what does the Old Testament teach in broad landscape kind of portraits? The third week is going to be kind of fun and interesting. I know the third week that there'll be some folks who want to be here for that one, and no doubt. The third week in particular is, why does the God of the Old Testament seem so ticked off? And the God of the New Testament seems so nice. Did he take a little medication between Malachi and Matthew? And I know that sounds terribly irreverent, but that's the accusation. The accusation is that, well, he's one kind of God back there, but he's a different kind of God. Oh, is that true? Now, granted, there's some hard things to understand, but in the Old Testament, you got a God whose justice you're going to have to deal with. What do we do with that? The fourth week is, how do you read the Old Testament so that your Christian life grows richer and deeper? How do you use it as a springboard to be more holy? And to cause you to fall down and say, I have an awesome God in your daily worship. Why are we doing all that? Well, because we need it. But part of the reason we're doing that is we're going to spend as a congregation the month of October in the book of Ezra. We're going to spend the month of November in the book of Nehemiah. And we're going to start the book of Isaiah in December. So this seems like a pretty good little package to put together to start it. By the way, you'll be bringing friends with you during the time. We'll put this little package together, hope to at least, of this four-week introduction. So if they come later on with you, there's a little four-week deal. Here's how you read and understand and look at the Old Testament a little bit. And so we'll have a series that we hope we have prepared. I want you to turn to Isaiah, the 40th chapter. I want you to catch a heart for the kinds of things you're going to read in the Old Testament. And so part of this is just simply catching the description of the awesome nature and wonder of God. It happens a lot in the Old Testament. But part of what we're going to pick up with then is just this question, is it true? We're going to pick one item, just one item, and try to deal with it. Is it true? Isaiah chapter 40 is a wonderful passage. We're going to start at the 10th verse. This was a 50-minute sermon when I preached it last night. With great success, I've cut it to 48 minutes for this morning. Actually, I'm trying to keep it around the 32-minute, 33-minute, just to fit within the time spans. And especially, I don't worry about you. I'll be honest with you, you're not my greatest concern. Because the truth of Scripture, none of us will be worn out by holding Bibles in our lap and studying Scripture. I'll tell you what my concern is. Those who look after your children are terrors. I'm just telling you that right now. They need rescued, okay? Oh, Lord, look after those who look after your children. So time, I always watch time more for the nursery than I actually do for in here, and you may wish I didn't, but that kind of is the issue. Isaiah 40, start at the 10th verse. Isaiah 40, verse 10 says, "See the sovereign Lord." Okay, what am I going to see? He's going to tell me two things I'll see. "See the sovereign Lord come with power, and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him." Let me just mention a couple, three issues here. What you're going to notice immediately is he says, here's what you're going to see when you see God come. You're going to see the arm of God. You're going to see power come. You're going to see recompense come. I mean, you just look at a... Never mind. Okay, bad illustration. I apologize. That one doesn't work. But here's your first view of God. I mean, I want you to know we have a God who comes, and this is a warrior's view, a judge's view. Power comes. But notice his next verse. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms. He carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. What an incredible contrast of two things that are true in God. Paul tells us, we're told in Scripture to consider the firmness or whatever of God and his mercy. The sternness of God and his mercy. Here it is, two factors that are here side by side. Here they are. I want you to see those. Verse 12, "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand?" Anybody besides God? "Or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens?" You want to talk about hands for a second? Look at your hand. What can you do with it? Well, I can hold maybe a, I don't know, how much can you hold out of a teaspoon or whatever in the palm of your hand? Can't hold much. I know what my hand does. Because of just woodworking and needing to have, if any material, you have the same kind of practice. That's 8 inches. And if I do something, you know, crazy with it, I can make it not 8 inches. But in general, that's 8 inches pretty precisely. That's 4 inches right there to that. That's what it is. And so when I'm working with a piece of walnut or a piece of cherry, I can roughly kind of do something. I know what that's going to be. That's what you do with teacups of water and a little cherry. This is what he does with all the water and all the oceans and all the lakes and all the ponds and all the atmosphere and all of the heavens. And it's just, it's what an awesome God you have. I'm going to drop down to verse 13. "Who has understood the mind of the Lord or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? And who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding?" Who counseled God? Verse 15, "Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They're regarded as dust on the scale." Whatever happened to that Roman Empire? And Charlemagne's empire, whatever took place with that one? I kind of forget. And what about... "He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust." Verse 16, I like, "Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires." Now, that didn't ring any bell for you, but if I said it this way, there's not enough wood in Colorado to build a decent altar fire for the living God. That's what he's saying. "Nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him, all the nations are nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless, as less than nothing." God is not challenged by anything anybody does at the White House or the Red House or the Blue House or the Green House. I don't care where it is. I mean, he is not too concerned. He's not pacing the floor pretty worried about something. Verse 18, "To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for an idol, a craftsman casts it, a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor for those things to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple or rot." What a ridiculous thing. This is, let me contrast your real God with what you guys are doing with your hands. Verse 21, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was formed? He sets enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing." What happened to that Napoleon guy? Didn't he die on an island somewhere? And what about Lenin or Stalin? Or what's the deal with the bunker with Hitler and his gun? Verse 24, "No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff." Verse 25, "To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing." Is God indeed that awesome? Isaiah ought to know. If you'd been reading earlier in Isaiah, in the 6th chapter, Isaiah is invited into heaven, or at least in the throne room. He's invited in the throne room and sees God. By the way, John chapter 1 says no one has seen God at any time. Jesus has revealed him. It's kind of interesting that in John chapter 12, Jesus even hints that it was Christ himself that Isaiah saw. It was Christ in all his glory, seems to be the hint in John 12. Isaiah says, I saw his train fill the temple. I saw his wonder, the holy, holy. I saw the seraphim. I'll tell you what I saw was awesome. And he begins to describe what was there. Is that true? Is that true? Well, one of the things it hinges on is whether or not God is in fact creator. Let's just take that one. Is God the creator? Because God, if he's not the creator, and that's not true, or if he's some passive God, not involved in creation in some form or fashion, however you can picture that, then this is not all entirely accurate. Look at verse 26, verse 12, and verse 22. They are all creation claims. They're all creation-centered. See, the message of the Old Testament is God created. You can't even start with reading the Old Testament if you don't find Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What are you going to do? You can't just say, I'm a follower of Jesus and I like all the stuff this direction. I don't know what to do with all of that Old Testament stuff. I don't know whether he did or didn't, and it doesn't really matter to me. The glory of God is either true or it's false. It matters. There's a guy named Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is an individual that taught at Oxford and Cambridge and some other places. He's taught at Cal Berkeley. Richard Dawkins, as a writer, made these claims. He says, the creative force of the universe is mindless and random. The creative force of the universe is evolution. And he goes further. He says, the creative force of the universe of evolution, anyone who cannot or will not confess that is either ignorant or stupid or insane or perhaps wicked. I mean, there you go. The creative force of the universe, that which drives it, is evolution. Mindless, random evolution. Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan said the cosmos. He said there were billions, too, a few times. But he says the cosmos is all there ever was. The cosmos is all there is. The cosmos is all there ever will be. What do? When the Old Testament tells you, here's your creator, and the world that you live in sort of says, if you really believe that, you're either ignorant or stupid or insane or maybe wicked. You look at our world, basically here's what you have. Our world, our universe, take the whole of it, take as much of it as you can put your hands around for a concept. Our universe is a ball or a box, whatever you want to call it, and you hold it up. There are only two possibilities for how it got here. I mean, there are only two. You're one of the two. Those two possibilities are these. Number one is at one point in time, there was nothing. Now, there was lots of nothing. There was an abundance of nothing. In fact, all the nothing you would ever want to build anything is there. So take all the nothing you want, and the nothing had a good day. I mean, it had a great day. In fact, the nothing began to percolate, and the nothing began to work, and the nothing began to create. And again, some debate, energy or matter, which one came first? But nothing and then matter began to create energy, or energy and nothing began to create matter. You just flip it whichever you want, but it began to create. And it began to create and had a lot of good days. Now, it took time. It took lots and lots of time. Now, no one can imagine how you do, but the magic ingredient you add is time. Time, if you want to turn a frog into a prince, you use the magic wand of time. I mean, you have to use time. Time is the unknown quantity. And so nothing kept working until I'd like you to hold up this baby and look at this baby, this brand new baby. This is a powerful cosmos. I'm telling you, this is a great cosmos. That's one theory. The other option you have is that we have something. And whatever the something is had to come from something greater because the something that's here is so incredibly complex and so incredibly integrated and so incredibly symmetric and symbiotic, any other word you want, that whatever the something is has to come from something greater or we wouldn't have any something. Now, I'll grant to you, both of them take faith. Nobody was there to see either one of them, not at least in this crowd. So you have to, by faith, start somewhere. So which one do you want to start with? Which one do you want to latch a hold of? There's a guy named William Paley who wrote a book a couple hundred years ago. I'm indebted to Dell. Blank on Dell's last name. I'll tell you later on. Dell is the one who tells this story. Good old Dell. He and I are just like that, too. Well, he's on my wife's side, so I don't know him as well. But anyhow, all the bright ones are on her side. Dell is the one who basically says it goes like this. William Paley says you are walking through a forest and you stub your toe and you reach down and you pick up something in the middle of this forest. And you pick it up and you go, wow, that is really odd. I've never seen anything quite like it. And you look at it, and it's got a little hand that goes slow, and it's got a bigger hand that goes faster, and it goes by some numbers, and you look it over really careful, and it seems like it has a really rhythm to it of some kind. And you put it to your ear, and it ticks, and you look it over, and you begin to slowly tear it apart. And as you tear it apart, you find there's a gear that moves another one that does this, and you find that there's, in this case, some circuitry, and then you go, wow, this forest is incredible. The pine sap around here must be phenomenal. I can't imagine anything. And you get to looking at it, and you go, gee whiz. And the more and deeper you go into it, the more astonished you are, and you say, I don't know how this could happen, but man, it's taken. I mean, all the rain and the freezing and the hail and the wind and the dust and the pine straw and the squirrels have messed with this some and the rabbits have come by and I am telling you, this is one incredible forest. His basic argument is this: no one would do that. Because at a certain level of complexity and a certain level of integration, a certain level of what things are, you recognize the very nature of a design requires a designer. That concept has been rejected by our culture. Here's what our culture has done. Our culture has said, take the box. And our culture has said, look at the box. And look within the box until you find its creator. And they've searched and hunted within the box and hunted and looked within the box and said, there is no creator. We find great intelligence, but it has to be mindless. It has to be random because we can't find the creator within the box. We have looked everywhere. He is not there. Therefore, we have to say evolution is that which creates it. That is the very same logic, by the way, of taking my watch apart, tearing it apart, evaluating it, and saying its creator is somewhere in there. And I'm going to hunt till I find him. I'm going to hunt till I find it. I'm going to look within the thing until I find the thing that made the thing. Well, you tear my watch apart, I know where you'll end up. You'll end up at the battery, which is a little complex, being electrical and material and all kinds of things. It's and you're going to end up going, oh, great battery, oh, mighty battery, oh, we bow our knee before thee, great battery, because the thing within the thing is all the thing you're going to find. Is that in fact logical? Is it in fact true within the thing? Could you go to your car and search and tear your car apart and look within it until you found the one who created, designed it, and built it? The answer is no. Neither can you look at the universe, tear it apart, do all you want without coming to this conclusion. It's incredibly complex. It is incredibly complicated and integrated. Things appear to be what they are in states that if they were only half of that, they could not sustain themselves in any shape or form. This is an incredibly complex world. Now, what I'm about to tell you is pretty important. There's been a seismic shift in the science world that you may or may not be aware of. All of us who grew up basically grew up with the knowledge that this world contains two indefutable aspects, energy and matter. Energy and matter, that's the essence of what we call the cosmos. You need to know that is now going out the door, and we're adding a third. The third element is going to show up. In fact, I will tell you, in my opinion, your children and grandchildren will laugh at the days of Darwinian evolution where energy and matter were considered the only ones, because the third element that is being added is information. Your science books, your textbooks begin to say there's incredible amounts of energy, matter, and information. Information that comes from where? It's random information that randomly got caught and random information that's passed on. You mean information doesn't require intelligence to have? No. You can have information without intelligence, and that great debate takes place. The complexity of this world, the deeper we get into it, forces you to say this watch is child's play to the reality of just even one human cell. Just a cell. You think of every single cell. Back when we didn't know much about cells and we could draw them in an eighth grade class and say, well, it has this nucleus and it has this and does that, we could sort of make it all kind of goo. But the deeper we've gone, the more incredible information we've had to say. There's information, not just energy and matter. What I'm about to show you is a 3.5-minute clip. This clip comes from the Truth Project from Focus on the Family, a phenomenal series. This series we probably will use very much at the church. It's about 12 hours. Del Tackett, good old friend of mine, Del Tackett is one who you will not see on this because we'll cut it off ahead of time. He hosts it and teaches it in a wonderful way. This series on the Truth series does, though, include a guy. You're going to see a little animated portion of what a human cell does. Now, you think the cells of your skin operate and do then different than the cells of your liver. The cells on your, but human cells do this. This is an animated 3.5-minute deal. You're going to hear a guy who's not very exciting speak afterwards. He and I came from the same school of learning to speak. But anyhow, this guy who's not very exciting is going to tell you he used to be a chemical evolutionist, but when he found the reality of the information within a cell, he came to the conclusion there is nothing that explains it outside of something outside of the something, a creator. I want you to watch this.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
Dr. Kenyon, most compelling evidence of design, and in his words, creator on the earth. Here's the funny thing. Richard Dawkins, when he teaches his classes, Francis Crick, who's one of the fellows who sort of discovered and began to label DNA, they both have quotes that go like this. I know it seems like it's designed by a designer, but it's, trust me, it's not. I know that the appearances are that it has a designer, but it's not. How do you know it's not? And the answer is, I refuse to accept that there's a sovereign God who has made the something, and me included, to be within the process of submitting to his authority. I refuse. You see, his opening quote that I use, that anyone who doesn't believe that mindless random evolution is the driving force of all creation is either ignorant or stupid or insane or wicked. You're going to have to decide what you do with that. Paul did it this way, Romans chapter 1. In Romans, the first chapter, Paul says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth. I refuse to consider that anything outside of the box. I will put in my textbook matter and energy that I do not know where they came from, and information and complexity. But, oh, great forest we live in. Who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what we may note about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. And we could go on. This morning, I don't mind telling you, when you read the Old Testament, it's going to bring you face to face with a God who is awesome and a creator. Now, there's a little passage I left out for commenting on when I read through Isaiah 40. Remember Isaiah 40 talked about what an awesome God we have? And then it's all about God. It's all about him, ultimately. And it does one little portion, and it's kind of funny, about idols. Idols built of gold and idols built of silver. Funny thing is, men have never made gods of gold and silver. They've always made gods out of ideas. Ideas are how you make gods. And ultimately, here's what our world has said. The God that I'm willing to build is one that is not sovereign over me. And the God I'm willing to build is contained within the box. And the box dictates what he can or cannot do. And the God I'm willing to build out of gold and silver and newsprint and papers and books and articles is a God that is random and holds no claims to my life. Well, the Old Testament says, behold your God. Behold the God who you'll see face to face, who's not in the box. One of the most glorious weeks I ever spent was a week in which five primary scientists came in. One, a nuclear physicist who worked for the government on nuclear projects out of the Tennessee project. One who headed up the geology department at the University of Michigan. His name is Morris. Many of you would know that name. A guy who did astronomy. This whole group of guys. They're scientists. They're engineers. But I remember them standing there. I remember them standing there that week. There were times with tears running down their cheeks. Guys with PhDs, guys who are quite familiar with the world of science. And they would weep, going, if we didn't have a biased world, all the glory of God that's being shouted out of everything we study, you could see. But men have made their gods out of their own imagination. And they suppress the truth. One man in particular, stoic individual, but he stood there and wept that day when he said, do you know the evidence for the flood is so overwhelming in geology? He said, the flood isn't, he said, there's no other, I mean, he said, there's just not any good ways to explain this world without the flood. The flood becomes the filter for understanding it, but there's such a bias because long before rational science came along as we know it, there was belief in the flood. And then rational science came on and rejected it. And now science is on a slippery slope. But if you come back and say, yes, a worldwide flood, they know the implications for that. And my colleagues would be bound to submit to a living God. And this guy's weeping over men he loved and cared for, who because of intellectual bias comes out of emotional responses. What are you going to do with the Old Testament, with its prophecies? We'll talk about that some. It's archaeology. It's great. We'll talk about these in the weeks to come. But the answer is you don't need to blush. You read it and say, this is the view of God my world would screen and suppress. But I do not need to blush. We sing an invitation hymn. Why would we sing an invitation hymn? The answer is you got to decide something, gang. You have to decide. Remember the two views that God has started with, either the strong arm or the gentle? Is God capricious on how he treats people? He just sort of makes up his mind capriciously on who gets the arm and who gets the gentle lamb, and the answer to that's no. He's a consistent God. Here's the question. Those who fight against his sovereignty will find he's a pretty unmovable God, and you'll find his arm. And if you're fighting against his sovereignty and resisting it, his arm is what you find. But those who understand his sovereignty and his wonder and awe, and it's the gentle shepherd they'll find. This invitation hymn is you get to decide which one you are. Would you stand as we sing?